This is AM. I'm Michael Brissenden. The former Labor Foreign Minister Bob Carr says Australia has a moral obligation to join US-led airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Syria. While some in Labor have questioned the legal basis for Australia to go across the border from Iraq into Syria, Mr. Carr says while they might not be ironclad, there are legal arguments for it. The Prime Minister has signalled he's keen for Australia to expand its role, but says the government plans to respond to a formal US request for Australian air power in a week or so. Labor is still considering whether to offer bipartisan support. Peter Donald reports from here at Parliament House.
The opposition wants more information about the legal and moral case for bombing Syria. The Labor leader Bill Shorten was briefed earlier this week and will meet his deputy Tanya Plibersek and defence spokesman Stephen Conroy today. But former Foreign Minister Bob Carr is not hesitating. He says Australia should do it.
We can trust the realism and the restraint of the Obama administration compared with the adventurism you saw from the Bush administration. And I think there is a powerful case to be made about Australia and the West making airstrikes where they're likely to have an impact in stopping ISIS from capturing territory in which it would subject the population to mass atrocity crimes. I think there's a humanitarian case.
When the idea of bombing Syria was first floated, Tanya Plibersek said there would be no clear legal basis for Australian involvement. While there is UN backing for Australian airstrikes in Iraq, there's no authorisation for going over the border into Syria. Bob Carr says there are legal arguments for it.
I think it is going to be hard to operate without a decision of the UN Security Council. But there is an obligation for us to act to prevent populations from mass atrocity crimes. It's reflected in the principle of responsibility to protect that the nations of the world agreed on in 2005. I'm not saying it's ironclad. I'm not saying it can be applied to what's happening in Syria clearly and unequivocally. But frankly, I think we can trust the restraint of the Obama administration. And I think the West has really got a moral obligation to act where it can be argued there's a chance of saving civilian populations from the mass atrocity crimes that seem to follow very quickly when ISIS takes control of territory.
Australia must not join in a bombing of Syria. In fact, I would go so far as to say it would be one of the most reckless things this government has ever done if it was to effectively help invade Syria.
Andrew Wilkie, a former senior intelligence officer, now independent MP. He doesn't believe there is a legal case to bomb Syria.
The Australian government has said that it would be acting on the legal advice of the US government. The US government is saying because we have the approval of the Iraqi government to bomb within Iraq, then the idea of collective defence could be extended to mean we would be legally empowered to bomb Syria. I mean, that's like saying that we can basically bomb anywhere in the world against any adversary of the US, which would be nonsense.
Independent MP Andrew Wilkie, ending that report from Peter Donald. Many analysts believe defeating IS will be impossible without targeting their positions across the border in Syria. The border itself is in many places ungoverned, and IS certainly makes no distinction about the sovereignty of the territory it occupies. I spoke a short time ago to counterinsurgency expert David Kilcullen in Washington. David Kilcullen, legalities to one side about whether Australia should be involved in airstrikes on Syria. Are Australian strike aircraft needed?
I think it depends how you define that. Already there are a number of countries engaged in the campaign in Syria, and that includes US, Canada, Great Britain, Turkey, UAE, Jordan, Qatar, you know, Saudi Arabia, a number of other regional partners. So there's a lot of people engaged. But if you look at the data, to date, the vast majority of strikes in Syria have been American. And certainly Australian aircraft would add some weight and some very professional capability to that. But in terms of volume, I mean, we'd probably be talking about half a dozen Australian strike aircraft. And that's not a game changer, put it that way.
Is this more about showing resolve for the mission in that sense, standing with the United States?
I'm sure that's part of the discussion. I think you could also make the case that ISIS is now really operating a single entity that crosses the boundaries of Iraq and Syria. So for the ultimate long-term objective of defeating ISIS, I think it is utterly essential to take the fight to them in Syria. Now, whether that's something that Australia wants to be part of is a question for the Australian government. But I think there's a military argument to be made that, you know, doing things in Iraq without also making an attempt in Syria is a bit of a waste of time.
Because one of the arguments is that the border between Syria and Iraq is effectively no longer governed by either side. What is the situation on the ground there?
Well, I think you could make that case. I mean, a large part of the border between Syria and Iraq is actually empty desert, but there are a number of traditional border crossings, border posts, and highway crossings that go across the frontier. And really, ever since about the end of May this year, none of those have been in the hands of either the Iraqi government or the Syrian government. They're all either uncontrolled or controlled by the Islamic State. So at the end of May, they really kept, around the same time as Ramadi and Palmyra in Syria and Iraq and Syria fell to ISIS, they also captured the last surviving border post. So to the extent that anyone controls it, I would say right now it's controlled by ISIS. But of course, ISIS don't even recognize the border as having any existence. They just treat the whole area as one single undifferentiated Islamic State.
One of the arguments, obviously, against the broadening of this mission is that this is, in a sense, mission creep. Where does this stop? I mean, if we say, okay, we go after them in Syria, presumably it could move anywhere, couldn't it?
I think that that's one of the critical questions. How do you define it? Because there are still, you know, significant ISIS operations going on in Libya and in the Sinai Peninsula. There's even a significant ISIS activity going on in Afghanistan. So, you know, where do you draw the line? So I think it is important to decide what constitutes, you know, the extent of our commitment. I would throw in another concern, which is it's not just a simple matter of saying we're going to, you know, send Aussie pilots over Syria and that's all it is. You have to think about refueling aircraft, which are a very important part of the Australian capability, reconnaissance aircraft. You've got to think about search and rescue, what happens to pilots that get shot down, you know, all sorts of other elements come into play. It's not just as simple as, you know, putting a pilot over the strike area. So I do think there's a lot to consider on the military side. But the political point that you, I think, rightly refer to is deciding, are we playing sort of, as the Americans would say, zone defense, or are we playing the man? Are we following ISIS, or are we declaring some kind of territorial limit to the operation?
And what's your view?
Well, to date, what we've really said is that we're there to help the Iraqi government. So that would suggest that the operations are really limited to Iraq or areas that can affect Iraq. And as I understand it, the current debate in Australia is to say, well, Syria is the heartland from which a lot of the attacks on Iraq are coming or could come. So by definition, it's part of that problem set. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't want to get into the issues of international law about the international boundary. But in a military sense, I think that's a valid argument. But then you could say, well, you know, is it in Australia's political interest to do that? And I think that's what the current debate is about.
And how about the politics in the United States? Because how important is it? How does the US see Australia's involvement? How important is it to them that we are involved?
Look, I think it's very important to the US military and to people in the Pentagon and the White House. Australia has a great reputation with the US and with other allies for being kind of a no-nonsense alliance partner who, you know, turns up and does the job and doesn't require, you know, lots of extravagant support and gets things done. So I think there's a huge amount of respect and interest in having Australia on board. As far as the American people are concerned, I'm not sure that most Americans have given a second thought to the possibility that any other countries are engaged in Iraq or Syria. There's not a lot of media reporting on that. I think to the extent that people do talk about it, they kind of assume that Australia's there. But look, I think there's a solid military argument for doing the job in Syria as an adjunct to doing the job in Iraq. But I think, you know, if you're thinking about, for want of a better term, alliance brownie points, I think we've already gotten those. I don't think we're getting that much more in a political sense by committing to Syria.
And I know this question is asked constantly and probably will be for a long time yet, but is the fight being won?
No. Syria, certainly the Syrian government over summer have lost very substantial amounts of ground. ISIS now controls more than half of Syrian territory. And in Iraq, there's been a huge political crisis over the summer between the former Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, and the current Prime Minister. And there's a whole series of protests going on across Iraq. And so what we're seeing, I think, is the lack of the political consensus and unity that would be needed to mount an effective military campaign. So the chance of, say, Mosul being recaptured anytime soon, I think, is very slim. And the chance even of Ramadi, the capital of Anbar that was captured by ISIS back in May, being retaken is also pretty slim. So right now, we're unfortunately more in a containment mode of trying to stop ISIS from continuing to expand. Nowhere close to beginning to roll ISIS back.
Counterinsurgency expert David Kilcullen. You're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's 21 minutes past 7. Global stocks have staged a major rebound after China's central bank cut interest rates to defend its crashing share market. European markets surged on the news, but Wall Street closed more than 1% weaker, cancelling out earlier gains. Despite China's emergency stimulus, concerns remain that a faster-than-expected slowdown in the Chinese economy could have fallout around the world. North America correspondent Michael Vincent.
No sooner had the street sweepers made their way past the big bronze bull statue and down to Wall Street than the traders were finishing their coffees and heading to their desks. Buoyed by the opening in Europe, there was a strong dose of optimism about US stocks.
I'm feeling pretty good. They'll come back up. They always do.
You're an optimist today. You're going to be a buyer?
Yeah, actually, I probably am. I mean, I think China was inflated and we needed a correction, and people should have known this was coming.
Some New Yorkers passing by were still rocked by the newspaper's front pages, like the Post's big grizzly picture and headline, Wild Bears Maul Marts in Dizzy Dow Spiral.
I feel scared, very scared. It's people's life savings, and we don't know what's going to happen.
But by and large, there was a good sense that yesterday's losses would be reversed. Fewer were happier to be heading into the New York Stock Exchange than Stephen Joyce.
I feel really good. We're in the hotel business. We're here to ring the bell. We're with Choice Hotels, and we're excited about where the market's headed today because we think we're going to help start a rise in the not only in the stock market, but also the U.S. economy, which is doing really well.
Soon after, the CEO rang the opening bell. Immediately, the Dow and the S&P 500 shot up, steadying at 2% higher. The Nasdaq went over 3%, its best one-day gain since 2011. Hank Smith from Haverford Trust says the correction has meant buying opportunities.
I think the bull market is still intact, and I think you buy on these dips. If you have cash on the sidelines, you commit that cash on the dips. You're never going to get the absolute bottom correctly.
The Nasdaq is still on track, though, for its worst month since November 2008. And the Dow is also on track for its worst month since 2009. But Hank Smith says that's nothing to fear.
I think we have a little bit more volatility to go. I wouldn't be surprised if this bounces around. But we do firmly believe that this is just a correction. It is nothing more. It's not the beginning of a bear market. Bear markets occur in anticipations of a recession. And there are no signs of a recession in the U.S. going out 12 to 18 months.
That prediction that a U.S. recession is still some time off has been helped again by fresh housing figures showing new home sales were higher than 5% in July. This is Michael Vincent at the New York Stock Exchange for AM.
Japan has gone from front-runner to becalmed in the three-boat race to build Australia's next fleet of submarines. The Japanese have been criticised for being too secretive, but today a delegation of Japanese government and industry officials will make their strongest move yet to get their bid back on track. The delegation will be in Adelaide and will front the Australian media for the first time. A Japanese defence advisor and former naval chief says Japan initially didn't understand the public relations game being played by its competitors, but now it does. In Adelaide, Natalie Whiting reports.
The French and German companies bidding for Australia's $20 billion submarine contract have been competing on two fronts, in the government's so-called competitive evaluation process and in the media. Japan has been avoiding the second battleground, but that's set to change today, with a delegation staging a press event in Adelaide before meeting with industry and visiting the shipyards. Former Japanese Commander-in-Chief, retired Rear Admiral Yoji Koda, says it's an important step.
Actually, the first exposure, or Japanese exposure to the Adelaide, you know. So that's really significant for the local peoples and also to the Australia itself, yeah.
Yoji Koda now works as an advisor to one of the country's shipbuilding companies and the National Security Secretary. This is the first time the pacifist country has competed in a defence bid like this, and it shows. He says they're rookies, and that's posed some problems.
The Japanese team is gradually, you know, solving those problems. But still, there are some areas Japan is not so doing well.
The Japanese have been criticised in the past for being too secretive. That's amplified by the PR offensive that their German and French competitors have launched. But Mr. Koda says the Japanese team is learning those tactics.
I strongly believe, you know, the engineering capability or technology of experience of building the larger submarine. I think Japan is still in the lead. But at the same time, there are several other things we need to take into consideration. One is the public relations.
Yes, do you think that's important in them, in the Japanese team, getting the Australian public on side?
Sure, of course. Japanese understanding is play in the within the soccer field or football field, just how well we will be able to build the submarine. And Japanese teams just started understanding those are another key things to win the game. So I think the Japanese team will allocate a lot of resources on those areas.
South Australian Independent Senator Nick Xenophon says he's glad to see the change in approach.
When I was in Japan a few weeks ago, I made that very point to them that in contrast to the Germans and the French, who have been engaging with industry and with media, there's been very little of that with the Japanese bid, and I thought it was important that the playing field be levelled.
A decision on the submarines will be made next year.
Natalie Whiting with that report. Would-be parents are abandoning their goal to adopt a child because of the long and arduous nature of the adoption process. That's one finding from a new survey of attitudes towards adoption in Australia. The research comes as the Prime Minister is lobbied from within his own ranks to make adoption easier. Angela Lavoie-Pierre reports.
Adoption in Australia has been in decline for decades, but new research from the pro-adoption group Adopt Change suggests people want that trend reversed.
Over 80% of the people we surveyed, and there was over 1,000 people involved in the survey, felt extremely positive towards adoption, felt that it provided children, at-risk and vulnerable children, with an opportunity they might not otherwise have.
Jane Hunt is the group's CEO. She's long made the case for adoption to be made easier for Australians.
54% of the respondents said, after having looked at all the information, they would be motivated to write to an MP or sign a petition or advocate for there to be changes in the system.
Adoption in Australia has declined by 76% since 1980. Jane Hunt says it's the process that's putting people off.
So about 17% of the survey respondents said that they had looked into adoption or had tried it, and then of that group, 87% of them don't continue with adoption. And the reasons that they give, the system is onerous. It takes a long time to adopt, so on average about 5 years in Australia. It's a negative process, so they felt that adoption was framed in a very negative way, and they felt for those who adopted overseas that the cost was very prohibitive.
Jane Hunt wants a national set of rules for adoption.
There needs to be a harmonisation. So at the moment, every state has a different requirement, so age or whether same-sex couples can adopt and a whole range of things. So harmonising that system.
Senator Zed Seselja is currently leading a push within the coalition to make adoption easier. He's seen the report and says politicians have some catching up to do.
There's an overwhelming positive approach to adoption in the community. We haven't seen that from our politicians in recent years, as reflected in the kind of policies that have been pursued.
Zed Seselja says the number of people who are put off by the difficulty of the adoption process is especially worrying.
It shouldn't be the case that it takes around 5 years to go through an adoption process in Australia when it takes something like 18 months in the United States. We have to do better.
Mr. Seselja has written to the Prime Minister Tony Abbott about the matter and says he'll raise it again in the coming weeks.
Angela Lavoie-Pierre with that report. And to finance now, as we've just heard, it's been a volatile day on Wall Street. After an earlier recovery, the Dow Jones Industrial Average swung back to close 1.3% weaker. There was also a big recovery on Europe's markets, with Germany's DAX index ending almost 5% higher. Oil is a little higher at $39.10 US a barrel, and the Australian dollar is lower at 71.25 US cents. And that's AM for today. I'm Michael Brissenden. It's 7:30.